This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. And before we really get rolling today, we want to give a shout out to Daisy Maxey, who wrote an article called Confronting Clients with Diversified Portfolios. Investors sometimes believe holding lots of individual stocks equals diversification, which was in the Wall Street Journal this week. It's the inspiration for our program today. So thank you, Daisy Maxey.
And no, Kathleen does not have a speech impediment when she said diversified, which is Daisy Maxey's wordplay on that idea that there is such a thing as too much diversification in a portfolio. And I would argue such a thing as, let's say, too little. Now, whether your portfolio holds too many different assets or too few, your portfolio's diversity or lack of diversity may be a reason why it's underperforming. How much diversification is too much, and how little is too little? We're going to get into that in the nitty-gritty of this idea today. In fact, this goes back to, you know, when I was in graduate school and I was first studying security analysis with Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett's mentor. And there have been a number of studies that, for example, you take a stock portfolio and you take, I don't know, 15, 20 stocks. Once you start going beyond 15, 20 stocks, you know what? You really don't accomplish that much. If you want to be in the energy sector, having 10 energy stocks doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe you only need two or three, and maybe you should focus on the best energy stocks in that sector. So we're going to talk about diversification, just the opposite of diversification, which is having a diverse portfolio, different asset classes. What you don't want to see, and we see this so often, I can remember an individual walking into my office. It was really hard. He didn't understand why his portfolio wasn't doing well. Looking at it, I have never seen so many mutual funds. It was like there was a mutual fund for every single sector, every single geography, and every single index. And what it was is it was really something that you just couldn't make much sense out of because it was too much of everything.
Right. And we should point out, Jim, this is someone who walked into our office with his portfolio from another advisory firm. It wasn't something we put together for the client. Just to be clear on that. Also, Jim, playing right into this idea of diversity, I know that you talked this week about 401k investment options with Jerry Schlichter. Jerry won a $35 million settlement last June against Prudential and Signacorp. And I know that one of the items in the lawsuit was failing to provide 401k participants with suitable investment alternatives. So if our listeners out there have ever felt that the five or so mutual funds offered by their 401k plans just aren't cutting it, well, you'll want to listen to this interview that's coming up with Jerry Schlichter in the second half of our program today.
Yeah, because sometimes when you put these plans into place, they want to keep it manageable. So, okay, we're going to have a large cap fund, let's say an S&P fund, we'll have a bond fund, we'll have a money market fund, maybe we'll have an international fund. And, you know, there's some argument in favor of just putting in a couple index funds. That way you're keeping track with the indexes and depending on your goals and objectives. But today there's just about a fund or an ETF for just about everything. You can buy into specific sectors. You can buy into bond funds with shorter durations. You can do a number of things, but no legitimate financial professional is going to advocate a portfolio of just a handful of investments. It just doesn't work. Now, on the other hand, portfolio diversity, the concepts are endless. Let's just take asset class. Diversification might include stocks, bonds, commodities, and cash. Or if you're in the stock market and you say, well, I don't want to be in the S&P. I think there are a number of sectors that are undervalued or doing well. There's sector diversification. There are 10 sectors that make up the S&P, from utilities, energy, consumer staples, all the way to technology and healthcare. So there are different sectors And those are just the 10 within the S&P. There are actually more than that. You can get even more specific. You can buy oil service. You can buy oil companies. You can buy certain kind of technology companies like chip companies. And then also, when you take a look at the stock market itself, we follow something called the S&P 1500 in our Markets Bill of Health, which is very encompassing and includes small cap, mid cap, large cap, and what we call macro cap stocks. And they even have micro cap, those real small companies, the startups, or oftentimes referred to as penny stocks. And then if you want even greater diversification, you can go outside the U.S. You can buy, let's say, sector funds or index funds that mirror the European markets. If you can buy funds that mirror Asia Pacific, Africa, South America. You can even find funds that go into just one country, Mexico, for example. And then also, if you want to talk about bonds, which we often do in the first hour of the program on the weekends, you can have short-term bonds, intermediate-term bonds, or long-term bonds. You can diversify by issuers, from corporations to municipal bonds that are tax-free, or governments. And not just the U.S., you can buy foreign government bonds as well. And you can also take a look at the ratings of those bonds. You can buy low-quality bonds, high-quality bonds, depending on what your risk tolerance is. Now, the idea behind diversity is obviously to spread the risk. You don't want all your eggs in one basket. And you want different exposure to different kinds of risk. And usually what you're trying to do is smooth the returns over a period of time. Now, the nice thing about a balanced portfolio, sometimes something in your portfolio is going to be going up. Other times it may be going nowhere, let's say just neutral, or it's going down. The important thing is you think back of the crisis in 2008, and let's say you're retired, and you had, 30, 40% of your portfolio in bonds. They would have held up during the downturn, and let's say you had some of your portfolio in cash and you had some in stocks. Obviously, if you didn't have all your money in stocks, with the market down 40 and 50%, your downturn would have been less than the downturn in the overall market. So the idea of diversification is there to protect you from that. And if you had some money in cash, you had some money in bonds, if you wanted to take advantage when the markets finally turned around, the economy began to pull out of a recession, you could move money out of cash, moved it into stocks, buying stocks at a lower price, or maybe you shifted money out of bonds into stocks. Or, for example, last year, the first year that bond funds actually went down in 5 years, you might have been able to shift some money in cash or out of bonds into stocks, which had one of its best years in nearly half a century. So the whole idea is, once again, to spread the risk, get exposure to different types of risks that are out there, smooth your returns, and make sure that everything in your portfolio is not correlated. In other words, if the market's going up, everything's going up, or the market's going down, everything's going down.
I think we would really be remiss here, Jim, if we didn't at least give a nod to the big daddy of modern portfolio theory, the gentleman whose work nearly every portfolio manager out there is familiar with and at some level or another tries to implement in their management strategy, and that's Harry Markowitz, who is an economist. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1990 for his concept of a modern portfolio theory, which was basically that he had this idea that if you had a certain risk level and a certain goal for your investments, that you could find a blend of assets that were non-correlated enough that you would be able to get the maximum possible return from that particular portfolio. And this was called the efficient frontier. Now, the whole idea, again, is that if you have a specific risk level and you have a specific goal in mind, you can find this blend of assets that if you just keep in those same assets at the same level indefinitely, that you'll get the maximum return from those assets together. Now, the kicker here is, Jim, is that there's no portfolio manager that I'm aware of that has found that magic ratio. There's a whole lot of different programs that try to approximate Harry Markowitz's work by plugging in different types of asset classes and their correlations to each other. But as far as I know, no one has found this. It's a concept. It's a theory. It's a goal for a lot of portfolio managers. But as far as I know, no one's found that perfect, infallible blend of assets that is going to always return, you know, a nice smooth return curve.
really what you're trying to do here is achieve a level of diversification and comfort that you feel like you're not overexposed to any area. And more importantly, that the risk levels that you're taking are appropriate to who you are as an individual. You can't be super aggressive when you're seeing the market go up last year, and we've seen that, where all of a sudden people that were conservative were out of the market, seeing stocks go up 30%. Oh, I want to all be in stocks. Then all of a sudden, as you've seen in the first part of the year, in the month of January, the markets were down. We were worried about emerging markets. In the month of February, the markets were down. We were worried about the trouble in the Crimea. Now we've got stocks at all-time records. The important point is each asset is sizable enough to have an impact, but not too much of an impact. And I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. It's sort of what you're trying to achieve is that Goldilocks portfolio. Not too big, not too small, but just about right. I know here when we manage money, we take positions normally 2.5 to 3%, maybe 5% if something is really a bargain, maybe offers a great dividend. And we also rebalance them when those positions get up to 7.5 and 10%, because obviously if you've had a great run-up in a stock and it gets to be 10% of your portfolio, imagine what happens when things change or conditions change or the asset market changes. And the best example I can give you of this, and we see this over and over, of all the repairs that we have done in the last couple of years with clients that have come in, I would say one of the biggest issues that we've had to deal with is they've put all their assets in one basket, and that has been primarily in commodities, most especially in the gold market. Now, what really strikes me about that is, yes, gold went up every single year for about 12 years. It seemed like a no-brainer. But the vast majority of money went into the gold market in 2010 and 2011, just as gold was hitting a peak at $1,900, and everybody was waiting for that Mad Max syndrome. The dollar was going to plunge, the economy was going to collapse, financial institutions were going to go under, and you were going to get filthy rich by being in gold. We heard talk about gold 5,000, gold 10,000, and gold was going to go nowhere but up to the moon. Does that sound familiar? Do you remember what it was like in the year 2000? We were in the new economy where you could invest in companies that had no sales or profits, but you were still going to get rich because everything was different. Same thing happened in 2011. And what really amazes me about this is it's kind of like investors are looking for a pill. They're looking for that perfect investment, the one investment that's going to give you security, it's going to give you a rate of return, it's going to give you income, it's going to protect you. Folks, there is no such thing as that perfect investment. And even the people that I have had on the show, very well-respected people, from Dr. Mark Faber to Barron's Roundtable member Felix Zuloff, even those who are in favor of gold, the highest percentage that I have ever heard from those experts is 20% in one asset class being gold. And that's if you're super aggressive. And yet, I've seen people walk into my office 50, 60, 70% invested in one sector. And then, look what happens. I don't care if you're looking at stocks, if you're looking at bonds, if you're looking at commodities, you never put 60, 70% of your portfolio in one asset class. You keep it diversified. And if one stock, let's say that you were in gold stocks, in the last decade, many of them doubled, tripled, quadrupled, went up tenfold. Wouldn't it have made a lot more sense to take some of that profit off the table rather than sit on something? Think what's happened to gold investors the last 3 years. Many of them coming in the market in 2010 and 2011. Look where they stand today. So if there's one lesson here that we want you to understand, don't put all your eggs in one basket, but also don't have so many baskets you don't know what you own, and it gets confusing to even follow them.
I think this last point is a really good one, Jim, because I think, let's take a look at the average mutual fund, which holds sometimes hundreds and hundreds of positions. And some of those positions are such a tiny weight for the overall mutual fund, they can't possibly be making much of a difference in that overall mutual fund's performance. And like you were saying, Jim, sometimes if your portfolio is over-diversified, it's really hard to figure out what exactly it's doing. What sectors are you in? What types of assets are you in? What's your weighting of each sector against each other? Your weighting of each type of asset against each other. So, you know, again, you want to kind of stick between, say, 20 and 30 different positions in your portfolio, whether that's positions divided among stocks, bonds, and commodities, whatever it is that you've decided to blend together in your portfolio, you know, roughly 20 to 30 different types of positions. More than that, and you just start to really dilute the effect of any one particular investment on the overall portfolio. I want to talk a little bit here, Jim, about being under-diversified. You know, you talked about people who are very much into gold or cash and gold, which we've seen so many of those portfolios over the last 5 years. But, you know, I want to just talk about times when it's appropriate to be under-diversified. And yes, there are times when it's appropriate to be under-diversified. I'll give you just a couple quick examples. Let's say that you're saving for a down payment on a home. So you want to have a specific down payment level for your home. You start to build up a cash portfolio, and you might build up enough cash that that cash starts to represent 20, maybe 30% of your liquid net worth. And in this particular situation, that's okay because that money has a very specific goal. Another time, maybe you're saving for your kids' college education, so you have a heavier weighting in bonds in your portfolio, and each of those bonds you have in your portfolio has a target due date in terms of its maturity date that's going to coincide with your kids' tuition payments. Again, very specific investment goal for those bonds. It's okay to be a little bit overweight in bonds in that type of situation. Or let's say that you have a different goal than growth for your particular investment. This whole idea of diversification is often to help people grow their assets overall, sometimes to mitigate risk. But if your overall purpose for your portfolio is income, it might make sense to be more overweight one sector versus another, let's say more overweight in fixed income like bonds, to meet that specific investment goal. So again, one size doesn't necessarily fit all. And there are times when for specific goals that you're trying to reach, specific purposes for your portfolio, you might be even dramatically overweight one particular area versus another. But again, that should always have a purpose and a reason for that to be the case.
Now, I want to move on to illustrate this point. Recently, in the last year, we took on a client in their mid-40s, entrepreneurs, kids away from home. They sold their biotech business with a substantial payout in terms of multiple millions of dollars. Now, what they did is it was suggested to them that they get an advisor. They went to a bank. They deposited some of the funds they got in cash. And what the bank proposed is, oh, we have a private wealth management group. Let's take a look at your situation and let's do a plan for you, which is what most people would want to do. It would be the sensible way, especially when you come into a large sum of money that could be life-changing. The problem was the plan had these pie charts. And literally, in the pie charts, it was a nice binder, pie charts, historical returns. It had so many different assets. I mean, literally, there was allocation to emerging markets. There was allocation to emerging market bonds. There was an allocation to a commodity hedge fund. There was hedge fund allocations. There was micro cap, small cap, large cap, international bonds, domestic bonds, short duration, long duration, middle duration, just about every single asset category you could think. The idea was there were 30 different ETFs, not to mention exposure to hedge funds. None of this made sense to the couple. First of all, this was a large sum of money. They sold the business that they thought they were going to be working and producing income. And because the payout was so large, they had now enough money to create a tax problem. So they had a tax issue because the assets were large enough. They would have a large taxable income. And especially with the proposal made by the bank, so many things didn't make sense or even fit what the couple was basically saying. Hey, we have all this money. We don't want to be paying large taxes because now we're going to be moving into even a higher tax bracket. So that was issue number one. Number two, they wanted a predictable source of income because that's what they were going to need to live on. And number three, they wanted to have a portfolio that produced income that was somewhat secure because this was their life savings. It was given to them when they sold their company that they put their blood, sweat, and tears in building. And so they wanted to be assured now that they had sold out, had these assets, that these assets were secure. The bank's proposal was, well, if we put them in so many things, There's nothing big enough here that could lose money. The problem is, a lot of the assets were really correlated.
Well, I think what was really interesting, and you sort of hinted at this, Jim, is that this proposal from one perspective would make a whole lot of sense. It really followed the guidelines of modern portfolio theory in terms of, you know, be exposed to international and mid-cap and small-cap and large-cap and all different kinds of bond funds. So really, the bank was doing a very well-established way of diversifying. In this particular case, you know, there were so many moving parts, it would have been hard to figure out what was actually working for the portfolio. But the second thing, really, Jim, was that diversification needs to have a purpose. Again, you need to understand why you're in different asset classes, why you're in different sectors, why you're in different bond maturities, and each one of those decisions has to have a purpose within the overall diversification of your portfolio. Now, in the case of this couple, they weren't really interested in growing their assets. And the proposal put forward by the bank was a very typical portfolio for someone who wants to grow their assets. That wasn't the goal for this couple. They had more than enough money. They weren't really worried about making it get bigger and bigger. They were worried about preserving it and getting income in a way that was smart, that wasn't going to cause a whole big tax problem for them, and that wasn't going to change in value a whole lot. So I think what was really interesting, Jim, is that the bank really didn't seem to hear what the client was saying as far as what they wanted from their portfolio. And they gave them a diverse portfolio that really wasn't suited to them as individual investors. It was kind of a blanket, typical allocation model for them.
And one of the things that we did is we took a look, and in this case, the payout or the sale of the business was substantial. I'm talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars. And that was the way this couple looked at it. They had so much money now that, number one, they had a tax problem. Number two, the money was so large they couldn't outspend it. Even if they changed their lifestyle and modified it and went and spent more money. And that was it. It was a large fortune, and they wanted to preserve that fortune, and the fortune was large enough, it was going to create a major tax problem. So here's what our solution was. We did a laddered municipal bond portfolio that was both state tax-free and federal tax-free. It produced a large stream of income that was tax-free, which would allow them to live, and these were high-quality bonds, they weren't low-quality bonds, and it would allow them to live the lifestyle they wanted to live without the worries of, gosh, we're into something that we're going to have to worry about. Now, we did put a modest allocation in the neighborhood of 25 to 30% in large, blue-chip, dividend-paying stocks, the kind of names, household names, brand franchises, the kind of stocks you would see in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, where there would be some dividend growth of income, but that dividend growth in income and the stock portfolio, even if the market went down, it would not disrupt their lifestyle in any way. What they wanted the most was low volatility, a low tax bill, and a predictable level of income. And the way that was done, a laddered muni bond portfolio gave them predictable income, reduced their taxes because the income was tax-free. It gave them low volatility, especially because the portfolio was laddered. And even that area that could fluctuate, more so than, let's say, bonds, the blue-chip stocks we put in the portfolio, well, they were household names. They just didn't. Let's put it this way. You don't worry about, you know, a large oil company or a large medical company or a large industrial company or a large technology company that has been around, and one of the companies have been around over 100 years and paid a dividend through the Depression, through World War II, and every recession bull market since that period of time. And that's how we solve this particular issue.
Now, if you're listening to the program today and wondering, am I over-diversified or under-diversified, or how do I diversify my portfolio? What are some of the things I should be thinking about? We're going to give you a couple of resources to look into. The first is a guide called The Pro's Guide to Diversification, which is available on Fidelity.com. The second one is The Beginner's Guide to Asset Allocation, Diversification, and Rebalancing on SEC.gov. The third, Building Your Portfolio Using Diversification on FINRA.org. and asset allocation on investor.gov. And we'll post links to all four of those articles on the website for you, so you'll be able to go ahead and just easily click on those links. But again, there's a lot of material out there from some very reputable firms and also our regulatory bodies about how to diversify your portfolio appropriately. So feel free to visit the website after this podcast and take a look at those resources.
Now, as we head into an interview with Jerry Schlichter, I want to just remind you, especially for those of you that are contributing to retirement plans, either in your own business or, let's say, 401k plans, 403b plans, 457 plans, take a look at your plan. Take a look at the expenses. Review your investment options. Are there any abuses? Are there enough investment alternatives? We'll talk about that with Jerry Schlichter, my guest, coming up right after this. Over the years, corporations have moved away from defined benefit pension plans to 401k plans. Just about every company has one, and employees are looking for them. But there are some problems with that 401k program. There could be limited choices, and unwittingly, someone else could be profiting at your expense. Joining me on the program today is Jerry Schlichter of the law firm Schlichter, Bogart & Denton. And Jerry, most companies have 401k programs today. Most people contribute on a weekly basis or monthly basis to them. But there are a lot of issues that are cropping up. I wonder if you might alert our listeners to what some of these issues are and why they may not be aware of them.
We start with fees. And let me give you a number that may be surprising to your listeners. A 1% difference in fees over a work life expectancy of 30 years makes a 28% difference in how much money you have left at the end of your retirement. So you're talking about almost a third of your retirement assets being affected by that, what seems like a small amount of fees. The reason is because they're compounded and all the fees you pay out do not earn any money, they take away from your ability to earn money. What we have found is that many plans are charging excessive fees.
And Jerry, define what excessive is, because I know that, for example, if I invest in a mutual fund, you know, obviously if I'm going in an index fund, the funds are cheaper. If I'm going into something that's actively managed, I can pay anywhere from 1% to 2%. Let's talk about what is excessive and what is the amount of these fees that you're finding.
Well, it varies, of course, but a mutual fund, an actively managed mutual fund, meaning a fund that somebody's picking stocks and paying someone to research stocks, may charge 1% or something over that. That's 100 basis points, a basis point being 1/100 of a percent. 1% doesn't sound like much, but again, when you're choosing active management, that is, you're betting that whoever's picking stocks is going to beat the market. It's important to remember that for every trade, every time somebody's betting they'll beat the market by buying, somebody else is betting they'll beat the market by selling. And Nobel Prize winner after Nobel Prize winner has said, nobody beats the market after fees consistently over time. So you pay more money for people to beat the market than you get if you buy an index fund, which you can buy these days for as little as 5 or 10 basis points, meaning 5 or 10 one-hundredths of a percent. And that's something that if you're looking at paying 1% or 100 basis points, you should look very carefully at the alternative of index funds, which give you a guaranteed market return without paying for active management.
So is your case against those funds that charge over 1%? In other words, where are the excessive fees coming from? Are they coming from a combination of fund charges, administrative charges, money that go to the administrators, or in what you see in some cases where you have some wrap fees involved, where you have a layer of fees?
Or multiple layers of fees. There's such a variation, it's hard to say any one rule, but a couple of rules of thumb that do apply are, first, if you work for a big company, that is a company with thousands of employees, meaning that you're going to have a larger 401k plan when all those employees' retirement assets are added together, then you should get the benefit of lower fees. Warren Buffett doesn't pay retail. And neither should an employee of a Fortune 500 company with a $500 million or $1 billion 401k plan, because the employer's duty is to get the benefit of that size, and it should be for active managed funds well under 1%. In every 401k plan, there's a need for record keeping. That's pretty straightforward. Somebody's got to keep track of balances and contributions and so on. Well, that doesn't cost any more money if you have more money in a 401k plan. The cost of record keeping should be on a per participant basis, $40 a year for each participant, whether they have $50,000 in their account or $5,000. Yet what's happening in many plans is that record keeping is being paid on an asset-based charge as a percentage of the assets in the account. And so if you simply decide you're going to put more money away for your retirement, or the market goes up like it did last year by 30%, your record keeping fees shouldn't go up at all because you're not getting any more service and it has nothing to do with the size of assets. The employer's duty is to monitor fees to make sure that's not happening. But we've seen in the cases that we have brought that that's not being done. And so those fees, if record keeping is being paid out of that expense ratio of the mutual fund, that 100 basis points or whatever it is, it's a giant red flag.
Let's talk about something else that may drive up fees, and that's revenue sharing, where whoever puts the plan together is sharing revenues either with broker dealers that work with the plan or other individuals. In other words, there's several people that are coming in and taking a piece of the pie. And because there's so many people taking a piece of the pie, the fees are higher.
Right. That's very common. And the revenue sharing that's paid out of mutual funds should be fully disclosed. The employer, plan sponsor, has the duty to its employees to make sure he or she knows what those fees are and how they're being assessed. And again, there are investment management fees, and then these expense ratios contain fees for sometimes a broker placement or sometimes for record keeping. Let's just talk about a broker for a minute. A 401k plan might need outside consulting help. And let's say I'm a small employer. I have a law firm. We have a 401k plan. I get the fact that it's time consuming and employers don't want to spend a lot of time on something that doesn't add to the bottom line, even if it is important for their employees. There's a tension there between the day job that an employer has and the 401k plan. But if you're going to have a 401k plan, you have a duty to your employees to be knowledgeable about the investment management space and to monitor fees. But if you have a consultant, there's nothing wrong with having a consultant, consider doing that on an hourly basis, a flat rate, rather than a percentage of assets. Because let's face it, the consultant who's saying, I think this is a good fund or that's a good fund, can say that without getting a piece of the action, so to speak. And that's one of the things that ought to be looked at by employers.
Many small businesses aren't as sophisticated as, let's say, a Fortune 500 company. They know that to attract employees, they need a 401k plan because people want to save for their retirement on a pre-tax basis. And in some cases, the employer contributes matching contributions. What can employers do to find out more about this? Because a lot of employers, that you know, this isn't where their interest is. Their interest is making their business grow. So how do employers protect themselves and their employees?
They have to develop knowledge. When we first began looking into this, we represent workers and employees, and we looked into what was going on in plans, and it took a year and 9 months, literally, for myself and people in my firm to get familiar with industry practices and things like this. And we came away convinced that there were abuses. But for an employer, probably getting a consultant, if the employer doesn't want to spend time digging and doing this, was helpful, just an independent consultant. But the consultant should be somebody who doesn't sell investment products because there's a self-interest involved there. It should be somebody who simply bills for their time and has expertise. And there are independent fiduciaries who advise employers, small employers or medium-sized employers, on what they should be doing. That's something that an employer ought to consider. Another thing the employer should consider is that you've got to periodically review the investment lineup and the fees. I recommend that that be done once a year because things change. Managers change, performance changes, and so on. I'd also suggest strong consideration to make it simpler for the employer of index funds. Again, much lower priced. They're reputable. Vanguard is a low-cost index fund supplier, for example, and I'm not here pushing anybody. But the federal government thrift savings plan for federal employees my mother was a widow, my father was a civil servant, lived on that pension plan for many years. They have only index funds. They don't have managers where they go through some process to see who they think can beat the market and charge higher fees while trying to do that. So what an employer, to simplify things, might do is consider a lineup of only index funds, 5, 6, 10 index funds, something like that, whatever they want to have. But that way their employees will pay much, much, much lower fees and will get a market return. Whatever that market is, that's what they'll get, whether it be a small cap fund or a large cap fund or an international fund or a bond fund.
What about also diversification? Because I've seen some plans where, you know, it's only one mutual fund company. And as we all know, I suppose if you were doing index funds, it wouldn't make a difference in terms of there's an S&P 500 fund. They're all going to look alike. The difference is expense ratios. But what about multiple fund choices, sector funds, things like ETFs? Are we starting to see more of those? Because a lot of times, I know in the government program, I know at one time there was only like 4 or 5 choices.
Yeah, there's a trade-off with choices, and choice is fine to a point, but there are all kinds of studies that say when you load up a fund with 20 or 30 or more choices, it becomes immobilizing and almost paralyzing. And what employees then do is they don't get in the 401k plan. Or they don't put much money into it, because having too many choices makes choosing difficult. It's no different than if you go to a restaurant and their menu is just so loaded up with so many pages, you can't decide what to eat. So keeping it simple, yeah, there should be diversification. The employee should have a choice, but I would suggest for employers, they limit that number of choices to something manageable, not 20 or 30, but something less than that. As far as sector funds, that's dangerous. For example, there are employers who had a technology fund. They said, well, my employers, we're a technology business. Our employees like technology. And in the technology crash of the year 2000, their employees suffered tremendously. A sector fund is quite highly dependent on that sector's performance, and that's a higher risk kind of fund for the employer and the employee. ETFs are more popular. There are some issues with ETFs, in particular liquidity, and I would advise employers to be very careful about putting ETF funds in a plan, especially because so many of them are not that large and therefore are illiquid, or there's a large spread between asking and bid prices.
Now, in an article written about you, they talked about that you have also sued employers over investment options which favor the employer over the workers. Explain that one.
The employer has a duty to operate the 401k plan for the sole benefit of the employees and retirees. Anytime someone's handling someone else's money, it's the employee's money. So what we were frankly shocked by when we started looking into this is that there were companies, and including large companies, that were benefiting from the employees' retirement assets.
In which way, Jerry?
Well, I'll give you an example. In the only trial in the history of the United States over excessive fees, there's only been one, and we handled that, was against a company called ABB, which used to be Westinghouse, and Fidelity. And what the judge found there was what we alleged to be true, which was that Fidelity was supplying record keeping for the 401k plan, but also providing administrative and record keeping services for the executive's defined benefit plan, for the health and welfare plan, and payroll processing. The court found that all three of those corporate plans, paid for by corporate dollars, were being furnished by Fidelity at a loss to Fidelity, while the 401k plan, they got well on, and they had over a 50% profit on the employees' plan record keeping. So what was happening was the employees were subsidizing the employers' plans with their own retirement assets. That's absolutely improper, and the court found that. They also found that Fidelity, the court found, was using the float from contributions or withdrawals, that period of time between the time you put in a check and the time it's cashed, for its own benefit, for Fidelity's own benefit. And that is also a violation of the law. Those are two examples.
So in summary, Jerry, put out some general things that an individual can do if they are contributing to a 401k plan. What are the things they should look at? And secondarily, What if your employer considering a 401k plan or have one and may not be aware of the things that we've just discussed?
The employee should read the materials that are furnished and look for what the breakdown of fees is. There are new disclosure requirements that came after we filed our lawsuits that require all fees to be broken down and explained, and that should be done. If they have any questions, they have a right to contact their employer, and I recommend they do, to ask, what are the specific fees here? What am I paying? What is the investment management fee? Another, if they have a large employer, they can ask, are you getting, you the employer, getting any benefit from the employee's 401k plan? And if so, what is that? These are things that the employee has a right to do. Their rights to do that are protected by federal law from retaliation. And if they have any questions, they should write a letter to the employer. They could also seek legal advice from someone knowledgeable in the space. But the first step is to try to get information through the employer and to read the participant communications fully that are sent to them. For the employer, the most important thing is to keep the overriding principle in mind that they must run the plan for the benefit of their employees, and they must be knowledgeable about the investment world. So again, if they don't want to take that all on, they can hire a consultant to help them with the selection of fund options or determining what the fees might be that are being charged. But they are held to a standard of being knowledgeable about this. It's not overwhelming. It can be done, and it can be done without fear. But if they have a consultant they use, they should have the consultant bill by the time, not by level of assets. It doesn't take any more time or effort to advise Warren Buffett whether stock A is a good stock or not than it takes to advise you or me. The fact that he's got a lot more money he might put into the stock shouldn't determine how much is paid for someone to analyze that stock. And the same thing holds true for an employer. And they should look seriously at index funds, because if they get index funds in the plan, they'll be assured of paying, their employees will pay low fees and have a market return. So if the bottom drops out of the market, that's bad, but that's not the employer's fault. If the market falls, but the investment falls more from an actively managed fund, that could raise questions about whether that was an appropriate investment in that plan.
And Jerry, what about the idea too? Because sometimes they're sold as no loads, but these backload funds or some mutual funds that have 5% fees. I mean, if you take some of the market returns that we've had in this recovery, putting aside last year's tremendous jump in the market, you pay 5% up front, or you don't pay 5% up front, but there's a backload, you're paying substantial fees to have that money managed.
You are absolutely right. You ought to stay away from any load funds whatsoever. There's no reason to go into them any more than there is to go dig yourself a hole, get in the hole, and then try to climb out to break even. That's what you're doing. You're putting yourself in a hole that you may never recover from, and there's no reason to do that. Nobody is that kind of an investment guru to justify those.
Jerry, where can listeners go to find out more information or become more educated in terms of the things that we've discussed here?
They can go to a number of sources. They can go to the Department of Labor website, DOL website, that has information about 401k plans and that oversees all 401k plans. They can Google 401k fees, and there are many articles, including some stories on cases that we've been involved in, that explain this in more detail. They also, if they have any specific questions, could go to my own firm's website, which is www.uselaws.com, and we would be happy to respond to any inquiries if they have a question. Those are some options. And just reading up in the financial space from publications is something that's always helpful for the employee. Everything from Barron's to some of the other trade publications. And they could also consider, if they have more desire for knowledge, subscribing to some of the newsletters or the publications such as Pensions and Investments or Investment News, which give further information.
Well, listen, Jerry, I want to thank you for coming on the program and informing our listeners of things that I'm sure many aren't even aware of. Thank you so much for your time.
Happy to do it.
Well, that concludes my interview with Jerry Schlechter. Once again, if you are contributing to a 401k program, make sure that your dollars are going to work for you. Jerry mentioned in the end of that interview some of the places you can go out to find some of the information, or simply go to your HR department and ask them for the very information that we talked about on the program to find out exactly how much are you paying, what are your choices. It's, after all, your money, and as he mentioned at the beginning of the interview, an additional 1% in fees over a lifetime of work can make a difference of having almost one-third more when you retire. So on behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I speak again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.